The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time is dated October 10/October 17, 2022. Time in large block letters is imprinted on a background of white. It has the usual red border on the front cover, with no inner border because the background is white. The general is the caption of the photo image on the cover, Valery Zaluzhny and the Ukrainian Way of War. It is a general in his dress uniform, a headshot, with his cap and his tunic and a white shirt and dark tie in rather a greenish charcoal gray color. But his image is superimposed upon an abstracted design of the Ukrainian flag, blue on top, yellow on the lower half. Beginning with the brief, Time With, artist Oliver Jeffers wants to paint the earth out of a corner, by Eliza Berman. Oliver Jeffers still keeps a studio in Brooklyn, where he lived for 17 years before returning to his native Belfast to be closer to family during the pandemic. When I met the author and artist in his studio on a drizzly afternoon, a few hours before he will recite an original poem at a gala for the UN General Assembly, it is awash in paint-splattered amusements. In one corner sits a ghost, a sheet with eye holes that Jeffers proudly says glows in the dark and really freaks people out. On a ceiling-high chalkboard, written in his signature scrawl, a cross between a child's handwriting and a ransom note, his list of tasks begins, glue moon. Sure enough, on a large painted moon, he's been testing out paper cutouts of astronauts from old books. There's a can of Modelo beer by the sink, old wooden drawers labeled sorry cards and library cards, and every artistic instrument imaginable. The scene is everything the mother of a four-year-old, Jeffers, devotee, could imagine. And then some. Jeffers, 44, best known for nearly 20 picture books he has both written and illustrated since 2004, and an additional 10-plus he has illustrated, many of them bestsellers and award winners, is a bedtime fixture in my house. In his work, he often balances his playful sensibility with serious topics. Earlier books constructed allegories around grief, the heart and the bottle, and friendship lost and found. Recent ones have tackled capitalist greed and environmentalism, the fate of Fausto, and walls, what will build. His latest, meanwhile, back on Earth, that came supposedly October 4, was largely inspired by trying to explain the conflict in Northern Ireland to outsiders. It follows a Jeffers-like dad and his son and daughter through the solar system in a car-turned-spaceship. They look back on dark moments in history, wars, colonization, cavemen fighting to survive. Images depicting tragic chapters are interspersed with those of the little green car, bickering siblings in the back seat. A dose of reality, a dash of whimsy. When I refer to Jeffers as a children's book author, he gently responds that he does not see himself that way. He makes picture books. They are primarily consumed by, but not specifically intended for, kids and parents. It just so happens most five-year-olds share my sense of humor, he says. But who's got much use for boxes these days? When he went to COP 26 in Glasgow last fall, none of the options for profession fit. Whoever made his name tag chose observer and translator, which felt just right. The subtitle of Meanwhile Back on Earth is A Cosmic View on Conflict, and it has strong Lenin-esque Imagine There's No Countries vibes. It calls to mind Earthrise, the first photo of Earth from space taken during 1968's Apollo 8 mission, which Jeffers suggests was perhaps less about exploring the moon than it was about looking back at the blue marble we live on. He tells the story of his own perspective-shifting moment when in 2017 he witnessed a total eclipse of the sun. He recalls standing in that path of totality. You are suddenly looking at a black hole in the sky. Jeffers felt the distance of 93 million miles, the way you can feel how far away a tree or a house is. It buckled the knees from under me. A lot of people, when confronted with the unfathomable vastness of the universe, feel insignificant to the point of apathy or even nihilism. Jeffers takes a different tack. When people feel nihilistic, they have not finished that thought. If nothing matters in a strange way, everything matters, he says. The chances of being here at all are so infinitesimal, why not just enjoy it as much as possible? Here is Oliver Jeffers in a photograph in a messy yet very well-organized studio. It's like a workbench with shelves above, all with books straight left to right, with cups of paints, I think, or paint brushes and pencils left to right. Smaller shelves with smaller objects left to right. It's all very neat and tidy, except it looks messy. It's got an old, worn floor that looks like it was sanded but never refinished. More drawers from about a person's seating height to the floor. And he's in a paint-spattered apron, seated on a stool, looking at the camera. Jeffers, quick facts, drawing attention. Jeffers grew up with three brothers and many cousins. His drawing skills had a pleasant effect. In a big family, and often ignored, I did whatever the hell I could to get some attention. For the kids, he's made several books for his own children. Here We Are explains the world to a newborn. What We'll Build imagines a father and daughter's future life together. Beyond the page. Jeffers' work has been adapted for a film narrated by Meryl Streep, provided visuals for U2 music videos, and been installed in large scale in spaces like New York City's High Line. From the View, Climate Change. Who will help preserve our nations? By Kaseya Natano. The climate crisis is creating an increasingly uncertain future for people in most parts of the world. Paradoxically, in my region, the Pacific, it is making our future increasingly certain. During this century, several Pacific Island nations will become uninhabitable. For my country, Tuvalu, which sits halfway between Hawaii and Australia, this could happen in the next 2 to 3 decades. Most societies see climate change as mainly about cutting carbon emissions or mitigating future impacts. We are facing a looming situation far more profound, the near certainty of terminal inundation. Our peoples, in my generation or the next, will be unable to exist on the islands that have nurtured our ancestors for centuries. Tuvalu and our Pacific neighbors have done nothing to cause climate change. Carbon emissions combined across the entirety of the Pacific Islands amount to less than 0.03% of the world's total. Even less if we speak of historical emissions. The existential threat we face is not of our making, but it will remake us. How we will negotiate this remaking is a question the international community must now urgently begin to address. Tuvalu is an acid test of leadership. If the international community allows an entire country to disappear from climate change, what hope will be left for anyone else? Science cannot tell us exactly when our homeland will become uninhabitable, but it does tell us how. As the ocean rises, salt water permeates aquifers that provide our drinking water. A rising ocean brings higher tides, and with increasing storm intensity, our villages and fields are devastated. Flooding leaves soil saline, which reduces crop yields and weakens trees. Infrastructure such as homes, roads, and power lines are washed away. The precious coral that supports our tourism and nurtures our fish stock perishes as the ocean warms and acidifies. The cost of eking out an existence of maintaining the status quo increases for individuals and the entire country, over time becoming too much to bear. This is how a Pacific atoll dies. This is how our islands will cease to exist. Tuvalu has not yet reached the end of this process of salination, destruction, degradation, and demise, but we are well past the beginning. Despite international agreements, global greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise, with many countries still pursuing a future fueled by coal, oil, and gas. Current international instruments, like the Convention on Statelessness, do not begin to cover our situation, nor do the UN's various efforts to address climate change. Agreements reached at its annual summits, including last year's COP26 in Glasgow, cover a wide range of issues like targets for cutting emissions or commitments for international finance to address impacts. But with regard to the looming uninhabitability of sovereign states, the conversations were disheartening. This is why Tuvalu, together with the Marshall Islands, is launching the Rising Nations Initiative to fill the current gaps in awareness, legal frameworks, and political commitment. The global community must begin a serious dialogue that acknowledges both the realities and the rights of Pacific Island nations like mine, and more fundamentally, of our citizens. We need a global settlement that guarantees nation states, such as Tuvalu and the Marshall Islands, a permanent existence beyond the inhabitable lifetime of our atoll homes. It must recognize and protect our cultural integrity, our human and economic capital, and our sovereignty. It must be co-created and enacted with the peoples and governments of island nations, not visited upon us by others. This settlement includes, ultimately, our relocation elsewhere in the world, where our peoples will be welcomed and celebrated. Our peoples will expect to maintain our sovereignty and citizenship, preserve our heritage, and be educated in our language and traditions. Economically, we can continue to support ourselves, in the case of Tuvalu, for example, using income from the continued sustainable use of the exclusive economic zone around our islands. Finding the right solution will require statesmanship and empathy, beginning with an acknowledgement that a situation globally caused must also have a globally just solution. We raise our children to respect the ocean, land, and sky as providers of life. Now we will soon have to abandon the ocean, land, and sky that have forged our cultures and identities. We neither castigate nor demand charity, but we do ask for generosity of spirit, support, and justice that recognizes our grave reality. The author of this article, Kausea, Kausea, Natano, Natano, is Prime Minister of Tuvalu, Tuvalu. There's a photo here. It's mostly sky and ocean, with the sky a pale, pale blue, bordered with white fluffy clouds, the ocean blue. There are ships sailing on it, perhaps fishing boats or cargo ships. And into that sea of blue, there's a strip of land. It really is just a strip. It's about 2 blocks wide. And I don't know how long it is because it extends out into kind of a snake's tail into the ocean. There's a lot of greenery on this, I guess, peninsula, or maybe it is the island as a whole. Lots of greenery, lots of buildings with red roofs and white roofs. And the caption reads, a strip of land between the Pacific Ocean on the right and the lagoon in Funafuti, Tuvalu, in 2019. The View essay, subtitled Society. The Family Moments, The Pandemic Stole, by Lori Fradkin. Over the course of 4th of July weekend, my 4-year-old son swiped his teenage cousin's hat approximately 1,675 times. He did this about the same number of times he grabbed his cousin's arm and yelled, "Gotcha!" We were on a trip with my husband's parents, his siblings, and their children, and I observed my kids as they swam, watched fireworks, and generally messed with their older cousins. They were so comfortable with everyone, despite how infrequently we had gotten together over the past few years. My family unit of 4 was on the stricter side when it came to COVID-19 precautions, and we had opted out of most group gatherings. We had taken this same trip for my mother-in-law's birthday the year before, but it was at a dude ranch, and all the activities were outdoors. We had done our own thing for the Jewish holidays. We had celebrated Thanksgiving with only my sister. We had masked up for a socially distanced bar mitzvah ceremony, leaving our kids at home with a babysitter. We were worried about the health risks posed by this new virus, especially as we waited for our kids to be vaccinated. Yes, we knew kids tend to fare better than adults. No, stats do not always bring comfort when you're making decisions about your child's health. Beyond that, we wanted to avoid the disruptions that would result from a confirmed case. Our now 6-year-old spent much of kindergarten on a hybrid schedule, meaning he got a large portion of his instruction in skills like reading over the computer. We did not want him to miss more school than he had to. We also, as much as we love him, did not want our younger son home for 10 days. We needed to work, and it turns out children can get bored of TV. Doing my job from home, skipping parties, RSVPing no to weddings. None of it felt like a major sacrifice, or at least I could not justify the participation weighed against the risks. To be fair, I'm not someone who needs a lot of in-person interaction. Even in non-pandemic times, I sometimes go long stretches between seeing friends, knowing we have a solid foundation. I'm also aware my kids are not me, and my older son reliably makes a friend at the playground. Still, for all the talk of the very real isolation children experienced during the pandemic, I was not especially concerned about mine. We were fortunate to have childcare for all but the initial months, so our kids spent most of the summer of 2020 in the park with their friends. We met other families for picnics and soccer. We ate under heat lamps in the cold. Once vaccines became available for adults, we began seeing my sister and in-laws indoors. My parents came up from Texas in December 2020 to quarantine before seeing us and returned at intervals after that. We tried to visit them, too, but got derailed twice, first when Delta made the trip too intimidating, then when my grandma and my older son separately contracted Omicron. Finally, in February 2022, we got there. It had been more than 2 years since my kids had seen my grandparents, and my younger son did not remember being on a plane. When I told him we'd eat breakfast at the airport, he responded, "For real life?" I thought we were doing okay. I was tightly wound in the way most parents were, but I kept thinking the kids, at least, were not missing much. Now I'm less sure. In August, we traveled to meet my parents, grandparents, aunt, uncle, and cousins in Colorado. There, my kids fell in love with their baby cousin and enlisted family members for games of Candyland. I watched my little one hold my 28-year-old cousin's hand to cross a stream, and my older one inspecting maps with my 86-year-old grandpa. Perhaps it's simply vacation I'm romanticizing, but I don't think so. Several times I looked over at my kids playing with my relatives, their relatives, forming their own bonds, and felt something I rarely feel about being with other people, longing, the desire for more of this. I do not regret how my husband and I have behaved during the pandemic. We have done our best to take care of our kids in the face of a disease whose long-term effects are not yet fully understood. And as COVID-19 is not over, we're still trying to keep our exposures limited. But with our younger son finally vaccinated, we are cracking open the door just a little to be with the people we love. Our kids are fine, but they all also need this. We all do. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. The many questions surrounding Italy's new right-wing leader. After parliamentary elections, Giorgia Meloni, leader of the Brothers of Italy party, is set to become the first woman to lead her country's government. That fact is obscured for many Europeans by accusations she will also be Italy's first fascist prime minister since World War II. Meloni flatly rejects this charge, despite her party's origins. Her party has handed fascism over to history, she insists. Some of her supporters say the fascist label is a slur, designed to weaken her appeal for Eurosceptic Italians, hungry for decisive leadership and change. In truth, 21st century Italy is hardly ripe for dictatorship, and there's no good reason to fear that Meloni, unlike fascists of the past century, wants to destroy her country's democracy. But her blunt anti-EU rhetoric, her outspoken homophobia, the intensity of her opposition to asylum seekers from across the Mediterranean, and her vocal support for the like-minded governments of EU member states, Hungary and Poland, are key to both her population with nationalist voters and the scrutiny she will face in Brussels. Meloni's political ascendance is not yet official. Italy's president must first invite her to try to form a government in a process that will take weeks. But the scale of her election win, Brothers of Italy won about 26%, and its coalition partners won an additional 18%, versus just 26% total from the entire center-left Democratic Party-led bloc, makes her government all but inevitable. The vote results will also boost her standing within her winning coalition. Support for firebrand Matteo Salvini's Lega and former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia was limited to single digits. The Europe-hating Italexit party won less than 2%, leaving it without a single seat in Parliament. Meloni's triumph is due in part to her calibrated campaign plan to shed the label of radical. She told voters and interviewers she wanted to change the EU, not abandon it. She has reassured Europeans and Americans that she fully supports NATO and Ukraine's fight to repel Russia's invasion. She's assured Brussels she wants to improve financial agreements with the EU. At least initially, these assurances will protect her government. Italy, with the second highest debt-to-GDP ratio in the EU, badly needs access to the 200 billion euros in COVID recovery funds promised by the European Commission in exchange for fiscal and other reforms. Italy also needs the European Central Bank to continue buying its debt. A sputtering economy, high inflation, and a coming energy crisis intensified by Russia's war in Ukraine and an EU bid to end Europe's addiction to Russian energy will only make that funding more necessary. But winter is coming. Economic hardship will also increase demand for help from hurting Italian voters. Pressure from the public and right-wing coalition partners to cut taxes and spend more money to help Italians pay their bills will grow. Will Meloni's woman of the people instincts lead her to pick new fights with the EU over money and minority and migrant rights? She will soon discover it's hard to remain a political rock star now that she has responsibility for the livelihoods of millions who are not predisposed to like her. She will have to remember, too, however, her coalition's clear majority of seats in Parliament does not reflect support from a majority of Italians. Her chance to form a government owes as much to the inability of the left and center to unite in opposition as to the breadth of her party's appeal across the country. Unlike other populist parties, Brothers of Italy remained outside the broad unity government she will now replace. Forming and maintaining a government in a country as politically volatile as Italy, which has now had 7 governments in the past 11 years, will require a flexibility and dexterity Meloni and her party have never before attempted. What's more, it was her campaign drive in the other direction, toward the center, that helped lift her party to victory. Which way will a coming crisis push Italy's new prime minister? It won't take long to find out. There is a photograph here of a blonde woman. Her eyes look like they're twinkling, but we can't see too much of her face because her hand is covering her mouth and nose. She's wearing a very pale blue, at least shoulder, attire, because that's all we see of her besides part of her face and her hair. She appears to be standing in front of a red, white, and green flag. Her name is spelled GIORGIAMELONI, and the photo is from her party's election night headquarters in Rome, September 26. From the View inbox. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. Now, there's a photo here. It is not captioned, but it looks like a small chapel of red stucco with white trim set in a forest. There's a lot of greenery in the front and to the side. A lot of tall trees as well as small shrubs and green grass. There's a brick-paved walkway into the entrance of this chapel, which has a portico with a gabled roof and a cross atop its peak. There are people walking into the chapel. To the text. During then-President Donald Trump's single term, he envisioned a spiteful shifting of migrants into Democratic strongholds. He even threatened to order the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, to sift through the thousands of newcomers seeking asylum in the hopes of finding the supposed hardened criminals and dispatching them to places like New York and California, with the goal of overrunning already stretched systems. The scheme ended up in the lap of Miles Taylor, who was then the top political hand at the DHS. Taylor recounted in a recent MSNBC interview how he sought a way out. "We went to our general counsel's office to find every way to go tell them it was illegal. We got enough options to go back to the White House," recalled Taylor, who resigned in June 2019 as the DHS's chief of staff and emerged as one of the most credible converts to never-Trumpism. "I have put all of the senior staff on an email and said, this is illegal. Now tell me what you want to do it. And there was crickets on the chain. Now, Taylor is not a lawyer, but if the former top aide at DHS saw the ploy as illegal, then surely some lawyers who specialize in such matters can find a way to stop the update of Trump's scheme that Republican governors are currently carrying out and looking to make a national splash for themselves, right? Certainly. But despite a faint sputter here and a performative protest there, Democrats are approaching Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' stunt of relocating roughly 50 migrants to Martha's Vineyard with the awareness that the September 14 flight was, in fact, a stunt. Yes, there are real victims here, but no one so far is rushing to get this on the congressional hearing schedule, a move they know DeSantis and other Republican governors behind this plot would milk for all it's worth. The backstory. DeSantis' allies allegedly recruited migrants amassed in Texas and persuaded them to board planes for a better life in the unsuspecting island communities of Martha's Vineyard. The flyers they were reading promised 8 months cash assistance, help in finding housing and schools for kids, transportation to job interviews, job training, and jobs themselves, and many other benefits. None, of course, were in the offing for these individuals early in the process of seeking asylum. The move is similar to what fellow Republican governors have been doing in recent months with thousands of migrants awaiting adjudication of asylum cases, an effort to jam liberal enclaves in California, New York, and Washington, D.C. Three governors, DeSantis, Doug Ducey of Arizona, and Greg Abbott of Texas, have presidential ambitions and are betting the mean-spirited exploitation of migrants helps their hand, particularly if Trump chooses to run again. After all, they've all accomplished the splashy export of fellow humans that eluded Trump. But this crass reality remains. DeSantis' stunt, despite the outrage it is drawing, might do far more for Republicans' fortunes than for Democrats. With Democrats heading into the last weeks of this election with a narrative about democracy and reproductive rights that they view as a winner, many are approaching these potential human rights violations cautiously, fearing they may muddle their careful messaging. Americans are telling pollsters that immigration is a second, if not third-tier issue. Ergo, it is not in Democrats' interest to move on issues with baked-in advantages for the GOP. The final push to Election Day is often the most uncomfortable, if revealing, stretch of our national therapy sessions. Elections hold a mirror up to societies, and the reflections these days are seldom flattering. It seems counter to Americans' better angels, but it should be clear by now, this is not an era when many leaders should be eager to meet Saint Peter. Beneath the caption, "Politics, the Defenders," conspiracy theorists want to run America's elections. These are the people standing in their way. By Charlotte Alter, Phoenix. Nobody recognizes Adrian Fontes, F-O-N-T-E-S, when he walks into a Phoenix lunch spot near his office. The former recorder of Maricopa County looks like any other Arizona dad. A neat beard, a blue button-down, the kind of guy you'd see cheering on the sidelines at one of his girls' softball games. He orders a burger with Swiss cheese and bacon, no bun, and launches into a monologue about his work to increase election transparency, like implementing a text messaging system to inform voters when their ballots were received and their votes have been counted. Fontes, 52, is a sixth-generation Mexican-American who can trace his Arizona ancestry back to 1695. One of his earliest memories is learning to play "You're a Grand Old Flag" on the auto harp for the 1976 bicentennial. He enlisted in the Marines at 22, willing to die for his country, he says. But Fontes does not think he's ever taken on a greater patriotic duty than the one he's attempting right now. "This is my first time being a high-profile candidate in a nationally important race," he says, pouring hot sauce on his French fries, "where the stakes are literally the fate of the free world." High profile's a bit of a stretch. Fontes is running for Arizona Secretary of State, a typically anonymous role that oversees the tedious details of election administration, training poll workers, managing the statewide voter registration database, verifying the accuracy of voting machines, and certifying election results. But in 2022, the job has taken on an outsized importance. Fontes' opponent, Republican Mark Finchem, is an election denier, an avid promoter of former President Donald Trump's baseless claim the 2020 election was stolen through widespread voter fraud. He's one of many Republicans running to oversee America's next elections while denying the legitimacy of the last one. If any of these candidates win, experts warn, they would possess a broad array of powers to undermine future elections if they don't like the results. A rogue election official could attempt to prematurely stop the counting of ballots, pervert the Electoral College process, turn over the outcome of the election to partisan state legislators, or simply refuse to certify the result, all while publicly sowing doubt about the validity of the contest. It could present an existential test for American democracy. If you can't have trusted, neutral people running our elections, then you don't really have free and fair elections, says Lawrence Norden, Senior Director of the Elections and Government Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, a law and policy institute. Then we're not a functioning democracy anymore. Fontes is part of a loose brigade of unassuming public servants on the front lines of the fight to protect America's election system from the Trump allies out to disrupt it. They are paper pushers and bureaucrats, not inspiring orators or ingenious policymakers or even particularly good politicians. If they were more charismatic, they might have picked a different line of work than election administration. They are Democrats and Republicans, incumbents and challengers, running for offices as big as governor and as small as county clerk. Many have met only in passing, if at all. They have little in common except a collective purpose. Each of them ran this year for an election oversight position against an opponent who embraces Trump's big lie. Fontes calls the group the most odd mutual support organization in the world. You could call them the defenders, the people running to serve as the bulwark between the will of the voters and the conspiracy theorists willing to subvert it. It is a battle that President Joe Biden has cast as the heart of the midterm campaigns. Equality and democracy are under assault by those Republicans who refuse to accept the results of a free election, Biden declared in a primetime speech September 1 in front of Philadelphia's Independence Hall. They are working right now, as I speak, in state after state to give power to decide elections in America to partisans and cronies, empowering election deniers to undermine democracy itself. Voters recognize the stakes. An August 31 Quinnipiac poll showed that two-thirds of Americans agree democracy's in peril. One of the only issues on which there was broad agreement across party, gender, and age. In an August NBC News poll, voters listed threat to democracy as the most important issue facing the country above cost of living and other economic challenges. Yet Biden's party was slow to grasp the vital importance of down-ballot contests like Secretary of State races. And even as Democrats touted the importance of protecting democracy, some party organizations, like the Democratic Governors Association and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, boosted election-denying Republicans in GOP primaries, believing they'd be easier to beat in November's general elections. Democratic candidates and committees spent nearly $44 million to aid Republicans, including many who endorsed Trump's falsehood that the 2020 race was rigged, according to an analysis from Open Secrets, a nonprofit that tracks money in politics. In Pennsylvania, Democratic candidate Josh Shapiro spent $840,000 on ads that helped lift election denier Doug Mastriano to victory in the GOP gubernatorial primary, more money than Mastriano spent on himself. If he wins the general election, Mastriano, who has been subpoenaed by the January 6 committee for his alleged work to overturn the outcome of the 2020 election, would appoint Pennsylvania's next Secretary of State, whose powers would include certifying the results in 2024. A single conspiracy theorist overseeing elections in a swing state could plunge the next presidential race into chaos or even change the result. If even one of these people win and they say, "We don't like these results," then we are in a constitutional crisis, says Ellen Kurtz, founder of iVote, which works to elect Democratic secretaries of state. "They will stop at nothing," Kurtz adds, "so we have to stop them." A few weeks before visiting Fontas in Arizona, I called his opponent. I was surprised Fincham was willing to talk. A state representative and professional realtor, Fincham marched at the Capitol January 6, 2021. He's a member of the Oath Keepers, an anti-government organization whose leader and other members have been charged with seditious conspiracy for their alleged role in the insurrection. After listening to him rattle off various debunked conspiracy theories about Dominion voting machines and mules stuffing ballots in drop boxes, I asked him a key question. If Biden wins Arizona in 2024, would Fincham certify that result as Secretary of State? Fincham chuckled. If the laws followed and legitimate votes have been counted, and Joe Biden ends up being the winner, he told me, I'm required under the law, if there's no fraud, to certify the election. But he added, I think you're proposing something that, quite frankly, is a fantasy. Why, I asked him, was it so impossible to believe Biden won in Arizona, as many polls predicted and post-election reviews confirmed? It strains credibility, Fincham responded. Isn't it interesting? I can't find anyone who will admit they voted for Joe Biden. Was it possible lots of people he didn't personally know had voted for Biden? In a fantasy world, anything's possible, Fincham said. Now, I'm going to begin to abridge this very lengthy article and stop here at a photograph. It is of a three-story, very long, probably limestone or sandstone building, and it has kind of an angel depicted on its gold dome, and standing in front of it is Fontas, at the Arizona Capitol in Phoenix, September 5. This is the 52-year-old Hispanic heritage man of Arizonan extraction. He has his arms crossed. He's looking directly into the camera. He's wearing glasses, a green polo shirt, and tan slacks. All right, going further. Before election deniers can radically reshape American democracy, they have to win their races. And that's when the defenders come in. For many of them, what was once a bid for a routine clerical position has become imbued with the weight of saving the American experiment. After January 6, we looked back and realized that was the end of the beginning, says Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat. We had to be prepared to endure a multi-year, multifaceted, nationally coordinated effort to enable those who tried and failed to undo the results in 2020 to succeed in 2024. Steve Simon, who has been Minnesota's Secretary of State since 2015, says the tone of this year's race is different. It used to be that angry callers to his office alleged wrongdoing by the other party, he says. Now the callers allege wrongdoing by the election administrators themselves. Simon, a Democrat, is running for re-election against a Republican who called the 2020 election the Big Rig and our 9/11. In the other races, it was a clash of political differences or policy differences, he says. Here the stakes are higher. It's really a referendum or judgment on the entire system. Some of the most important defenders are Republicans who vouch for the integrity of the 2020 election while beating back election deniers in GOP primaries. It's been very challenging as an elections professional and a lifelong Republican to see people embrace that conspiracy so fervently, says Pam Anderson, who served as clerk and recorder for Jefferson County, Colorado, for 8 years and was president of the Colorado County Clerks Association. In June, Anderson won the GOP nomination for Colorado Secretary of State over Tina Peters, who was promoted voter fraud conspiracy theories, and was recently indicted on multiple felony charges in connection with an alleged election security breach. She has pleaded not guilty. Anderson is trying to thread the needle between the two parties' rhetoric about voting. Security equals suppression for the left, and access equals fraud on the right, Anderson says. I don't believe either of those things. In Nebraska, Republican Secretary of State Bob Evnen circulated a detailed PowerPoint presentation titled Fake versus Fact, debunking popular conspiracy theories about the 2020 election. In Idaho, Ada County Clerk Phil McGrain defeated two election deniers to win the GOP nomination for Secretary of State. One of my opponents suggested they would decertify election equipment, and that's alarming to me, says McGrain. There are some things that are just logical and practical and have to work. Brad Raffensperger, who served as Georgia Secretary of State since 2019, famously resisted Trump's demands to find more than 11,000 votes to tip the results of the 2020 presidential election in the Peach State. After he refused to bow to that pressure, Raffensperger's wife was harassed with sexual text messages, and his daughter-in-law's home was broken into, he told the January 6 committee. In May, Raffensperger vanquished a Trump-aligned challenger to win the party's nomination. We have hinge points throughout our American history, he says, pointing to the Civil War as an example. I think that if we have people of integrity that will stand in the gap and follow the law and do their job, that's how we move through this. Character, he adds, is not a partisan issue. The heat is radiating off the pavement at the Arizona Strip Mall, where Adrian Fontes is kicking off an early Saturday morning canvas. It's the weekend before Labor Day, and signs for Republican candidates for Senate and governor crowd street corners in the Phoenix area. Roughly a dozen volunteers mill around with clipboards, preparing to disperse into the hot morning. Fontes is there to explain why voters should care about the Secretary of State race. Electing Fincham, he says, would create chaos and uncertainty that would pervade everything from voting to business. Elections are the golden thread that run through the entire fabric of our society, he adds. If you pull the thread out, the entire fabric disintegrates. Off to the side, Stephen Eshelman, 70, is wearing a hat and shirt that say, "Protect Democracy, Elect Fontes." Eshelman is one of Fontes' most loyal supporters, showing up to many of his events. "If we lose this election, our democracy's in peril," says Eshelman. Who knows what they could do next time? Other Fontes supporters say they're annoyed so few people seem to be paying attention to the candidates trying to repel the threat. "They're giving so much free publicity to all the Republicans," says Elaine McGuire, as she hoists a Fontes yard sign up at an event in Phoenix later that day. "It's revving up the MAGA people." Democrats are waking up to the importance of these races. The Democratic Association of Secretaries of State has raised more than $16 million this cycle, a tenfold increase over the most recent midterm, although still a fraction of what the party raises for other races. For iVote, the group supporting Democratic candidates for Secretary of State, its $15 million budget this year is more than double what it spent in 2018. "We are paying more attention than we ever have before," says Amanda Littman, co-founder of Run for Something, a group that recruits and trains Democratic candidates to run for local offices. "Yet for years, Republicans have invested more in those races. We are starting at a deficit," Littman says. Fontes is not focused on the national trends or the broader threat. He's just trying to win his race. "It's weird being in the eye of the storm," he says. "In the face of conspiracy, suspicion, and lies, he's motivated by a belief in his fellow Americans. Voters will see through the nonsense," he says. "Once they start paying attention, they'll see the faith they've lost in their fellow citizens ought to come back." This article was written by Charlotte Alter, Phoenix, with reporting by Julia Zorthian and Mariah Espada. It was somewhat abridged. And this small article may also be abridged. Activists say Iran protests mark a reality shift. And this is by Carl Vick. "Three times since 2009, Iranians have taken to the streets to protest the transgressions of their government, each time drawing first the attention of the world and then the wrath of the Islamic Republic as paramilitaries restored its version of order. But in the outcry that's erupted nationwide since the September 16 death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old who died in the custody of the morality police after being detained over Iran's strict religious dress code, activists see a hinge event. The killing of Mahsa Amini really embodies by itself the 43 years of pain that women have endured in this country," Nazrin Sotouda, a prominent Iranian human rights lawyer, tells Time from Tehran. "This is for us a physical bodily experience. It is the most real experience of life here. We are condemned to live in a tunnel of death." And the person who died at the hands of the morality police, Mahsa, M-A-H-S-A, Amini, A-M-I-N-I. Mandatory hijab is a pillar of the theocracy that came to power in 1979, but today retains the support of only a minority of Iranians. This is a totalitarian system whose presence people feel in their blood and in their flesh on a daily basis. One that does not accommodate freedoms of any kind, says the lawyer, who's on medical furlough from a 38-year prison sentence for defending activists. What's increasingly clear is that people want change in the regime, and there is a real possibility of regime change in Iran. That possibility drives a government response that claimed at least 75 lives in the first day of protests alone. The most likely next steps will be that the crackdown will continue, but so too will the protests, Sotoudeh says. I do not envisage a return to the past. Even if the people's demands are not met, the reality will have shifted permanently. There's a photo here depicting some of these protests in Iran. It's a street, or rather an avenue, multi-lanes, lined with trees, and in the background a tall building, and cars and people are thronging this roadway. There would be no way to make one step forward or backward. It is simply jam-packed with people and automobiles in the protest. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.